listen into it right now, when I listen to it, oh boy, it's got a lot of action right now, Eric. So I don't know how you can arrange it so that the Eastern input will be active for Paul, but not active for this guy. He's having a grand old time in the Eastern input right now. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
I got plenty of power to go the other way, Jay.
Okay, you sound good. Go right ahead, Paul. You sound good. WSGN, K2RIW. Tell us what NASA has been doing. You got it, Paul.
Yeah, I'll go east or west, no problem. Yeah, Dick, there isn't all that much news. No launches coming up this week. So I wanted to go over a couple of things that the International Space Station is always doing. Right now, the Russians are getting ready to send an Expedition 41 through up to September. There'll be one more before.
Yeah, copy. Southern State.
Investigate.
And again, just if you are in the car or feel like...
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
Loud and loud, I think we'll talk, Richie.
But cameras on board, so take them back. Another unmanned launch in 2017. And another one after that will be manned. They'll probably put the thing into orbit around the moon and bring it back. That's going to be the new big rocket for NASA. That's all I wanted to cover for tonight, Dick. Any questions? I could be reached at...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I don't know if I got through, but back to you, Dick.
K2RIW testing. SpaceNetReport@gmail.com. SpaceNetReport@gmail.com is the little portion of the end that chopped off by timeout, Eric. And about 70% of what you said did come through very nicely, Eric. But this particular guy is an awfully unhappy individual. I feel sorry for him. His motive in life is to be disruptive, and how he can brag about that to his friends and get appreciation, I don't know. We were getting reports from Rich K2KNB as to where he is. We were also getting reports from Rich and Toledo as to how loud he was hearing him on the input. So this guy, he is mobile. He's equipped on multiple frequencies, and he's running back and forth and doing as much jamming as he can. Whatever you hear on the input, no matter which input you're hearing him on, 146.85, 147.375, or 449.125, no matter where you hear him, if you can flip over to the input frequency, the so-called reverse mode of your rig, and write down what signal strength you got at what time. We'll try to be accurate in the timing. And where you located, if you happen to be mobile, or where you're located, if you happen to be fixed, and the FCC records or the QRZ records that don't necessarily represent your most recent address. Tell us where you are, what time you heard it, how strong it was. Help track down this individual, and hopefully we can eventually convince him that this is not the best way to spend his life. Paul, as I said, about 75% of what you said came through very well. The other 25% did get quite disrupted, unfortunately. So you may have to report, you may have to repeat portions of it next week. That donut that they saw under the wheel, let me drop it. That donut they saw under the wheel of Curiosity on Mars, I think they eventually figured that out as being the something created by the wheel itself as it rolled over the rock. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW? all of us are doing a better and better job of tracking signals transfers of time for various locations. So this will get better. Eventually, we're going to have to discourage this particular very disgruntled individual. Don't bother getting angry at him. We should feel sorry for him as opposed to get angry at him. How he can spend his life this way, sometimes 20 hours a day. He appears to be a person that's not working. He's got an awful lot of free time on his hands. Well, at least one of the guys falls into that category. Unfortunately, there seems to be more than one of them.
He's got free gas, too.
Yeah, he talked somebody else into joining him. What do you mean by free gas, John? KC2WGB, KQRIW?
Well, if you think about the distance he actually traverses in trying to interfere at great length, it's kind of expensive. Makes you wonder.
Yeah, Paul, you're coming through very well through the Eastern machine. Unfortunately, the Eastern machine tonight is not directly coming through the Western machine. So the people listening to only the Western machine output and not necessarily hearing what you're saying. Oh, well. So it was worth a try. You were right to use the Western input. And we did hear very nicely 70-some-odd percent of what you said, but some of it did disrupt it. When I hear my voice coming back with delay, it gets me a little confused. Let's see. I'm looking for a suggestion, John. What do you recommend we do next? I don't know. I guess I'll give one more try. Can anybody get through the Western machine now? Right now, Freddie, for instance, Mr. VBN. Let's see if we can hear you, Freddie. K2RIW on the TechNet. I heard somebody on the input say, can anybody hear me? Give me your full call letters and name, and I'll relay what you're saying. He said, can anybody hear me? Go right ahead. K2RIW. My name is Dick. Turns out I'm hearing you very well on the input, Andy, CDL, but you're not coming through the machine at this time. So go right ahead with your suggestion. The A2CDL. Sorry, I didn't recognize your voice right away. K2RIW. I got too many radios running at once here, Andy. Very fine, Andy. You came through on my input frequency very well, on 2.5. You did not come out of the machine. But Andy did recommend that we say something on that particular subject. There is going to be a very nice flea market run by Limark at the Levittown Hall in 2 weeks. So Sunday, 2 weeks from now, you know what date that is when you look at your calendar. Levittown Hall is going to be filled up with people buying and selling pieces of electronics, mostly wireless pieces of electronics. So it's something to look forward to. Anything else I should mention along those lines, Andy? Andy at the B2CDL will be running his usual tune-up clinic. You go up on the stage to the rear left-hand corner of the stage when you're looking from the front of the room where you come in. Andy sets up his stand there every flea market for the last million years. So your handy talkies, your mobile rigs, he's equipped to measure their deviation, their level of PL tone, how much speech clipping, audio volume, power output, frequency accuracy. He can supply all that for you. What if there's anything else I should mention, Andy? W2CDL on the input, K2RIW on the segment.
KC2DAW for the segment.
Roger, Dodger. I'm listening to the tail end of Andy, and then I'm going to pick up KC2BAW. Stand by a minute. Okay, Andy has finished. KC2BAW. KC2BAW? Correct me if I got your call letters wrong, and give us your name, and then proceed with your question or comment. KC2BAW, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RW, this is KC2BAW, Kilo Charlie 2, Delta Alpha Whiskey. Just wanted to let you know that I'm on listening.
Okay, KC2, Delta Alpha Whiskey. He wants us to know that he's listening. I thought he had a question. I wonder if you've got a suggestion as to what we should be doing next under the particular circumstances. KC2, WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
KC2, WGB. I'd like to know if Glenn, QIQ, is available.
Let's see if he's around. KC2, QIQ, our light-emitting diode expert, among other subjects. Are you there, Glenn? We'd like to hear from you. K2IW. I'm not hearing him, John. You got a specific question for Glenn, John? Go right ahead, John.
Yes, the only question I have left over, and I wanted him to give, he had given me a great description, very succinct, right to the point, on how the diode works. Excellent job, and I was going to ask him to repeat that on the net, because we had done that at late at night, and that worked out well. And I have somebody waiting for that answer, and my mailbag is empty because of this stuff that's going on. But I'd like to say that the email address is jb5oscar@aol.com. I know it's rough, but be patient and we'll try to get your questions answered. And right now the mailbox is empty, so we're okay.
And I think you should indicate that email address one more time, John, because it's unusual. It looks like it's a number, but there really are letters in there, Oscar, Oscar. So repeat that email address for people who don't yet have their ham license or don't yet have the equipment to talk to us directly on the air. I'm going to send a question to John's mailbag. John's going to give you that email address right now. KC2WGV, K2RAW in the TechNet. You got it, John.
Very good, then. Okay, it's JD, Juliet Bravo, 5, Oscar, Oscar, at AOL.com. JD5, Oscar, Oscar, at AOL.com. And just type in the questions, and I'll repeat what Dick has mentioned many times. There are no dumb questions, guys. Simple questions. Science questions. Anything you'd like to have asked or answered on the TechNet. And if we don't have an answer, I'm sure that in time we'll find somebody who will have an answer for you. So we do that pretty well. And occasionally we make mistakes, but we used to straighten them out too. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, what's so unusual about John's email address, when you see it printed out and you look at Juliet Bravo 5, Oscar, Oscar, at AOL.com, it looks like you're looking at a number, JD500. It is not 500. It's 5 Oscar Oscar. So it's a fooler, if you know what I mean. John chose a fairly tough one there. But that's how you write to John when you've got questions. And we try to handle questions primarily on radio amateur, but sometimes astronomy, sometimes other kinds of science. I think it was the National Science Foundation is on the news for the last couple of days, a couple of Newsday reports, New York Times reports, where they did a survey of the American population, and when it comes to science literacy, we're doing moderately well. There's some holes in the knowledge, so to speak. A significant number of people in the United States do not know that the Earth goes around the sun. That's a little bit disappointing. If you get deeper in that, then you can start asking people at what angle will the sun rise on March 21 versus June 21? What angle will the sun rise and set at your house? It's getting kind of complicated with that. But the fact that the Earth goes around the sun, a significant percentage of the population doesn't know that. And that's a bit disappointing. You don't need to know. Every American doesn't need to know astronomy, but there's certain basic things you'd like to believe your high school or your college didn't teach you. And when it comes to science literacy, there's a lot of advantages I see it. Let me drop.
I got one for you, Dick.
Yeah, I'm going to get to you in a minute, John. There's a lot of advantage in studying science. Mother Nature is giving us some very strong messages when it comes to botany, biology, astronomy, radio propagation. I have been studying radio propagation for 45 solid years. I've got a bunch of patent applications with my name on it. There are people who think, make the mistake of thinking I understand radio propagation. You'll be amazed how recently I've learned some brand new things about how a radio wave propagates, whether it's down a waveguide, whether it's coming out of an antenna, whatever. How recently, how late in life, I've learned some of the details. And from one respect, it's disappointing me. From another point of view, I can say, hey, the way we teach these subjects in our schools leaves a lot to be desired. There's really a lot more complication going on. It's another one of those situations, let me drop, where you can have a lot of fun with your science friends. One of the questions that I frequently ask people is that, okay, mankind has been studying all kinds of science subjects an awful lot for a long time. Give me an example. Choose a subject. Choose a subject for me that you think mankind has studied it pretty well and we understand it. Name the subject that you think we really understand. You'd be amazed how difficult it is to answer that question. But a guy who's got some of the answers is one of these guys in the borough of Staten Island. Hey, John, go right ahead. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the tech net.
KC2WGB. I think we understand that pretty basically, but that's probably it. But Dick, it's amazing. You happen to mention a simple subject. Well, you would be surprised if you asked people, we're warm in the summer, cold in the winter? Yeah. We're closer to the sun. Oh my God. What is going on with these people? And I've heard the same story. In Mexico, it's warmer because they're on the fatter part of the earth, so it's closer to the sun. I mean, you know, that's kind of hard to understand.
Yeah, that's a tough one, John, for many people. When you study the way the earth goes around the sun, the slightly elliptical orbit, believe it or not, the earth is closest to the sun, I think it's on January 6th. That's the apogee and perigee represent the orbit around the earth.
Perigee.
Yeah, you would call it perigee, but G means earth, okay? It's a parasol, the solar orbit, and there's a fancy word I can't think of right now. Anyhow, the earth is closest to the sun on January 6th.
Perihelion?
Perihelion, that's the word. Somebody said it on the input. Thank goodness. Perihelion, aphelion. Helium, the sun. Because the earth is tilted on its axis, the north pole of the earth is tilted toward the sun at a maximum amount on June 21, the summer solstice. Therefore, the summer, the northern hemisphere enjoys summer in June. The people who live in the southern hemisphere have it the opposite way. The most popular thing to do in Australia on Christmas Day is to go swimming. It's one of the hottest days of the year in Australia, in the southern hemisphere, because around December 21, at the winter solstice, the southern hemisphere of the earth is tilted closest to the sun. The people in Barrow, Alaska, are in 24 hours of darkness. The people at the North Pole are in darkness. The people in the South Pole are in 24 hours of brightness, of the continuous daylight on December 21, because of the tilt of our axis. So it turns out that the little bit of difference, let me just... The little bit of difference in the distance of Earth to the Sun, that 93 million miles, changes very little. But yeah, the aphelion, the closest the Earth gets to the Sun, is somewhere around January 6th to January 8th, I think it is. But the variation of distance is a second-order effect. That's not what's creating summer and winter. It's the tilt of our axis In other words, the Earth rotates on an axis that is tilted compared to the plane of our orbit. And what we in the Northern Hemisphere call summer is a period of time when the axis is tilted toward the sun, in the summertime. The axis of the Earth is an extremely good gyroscope. That axis points very close to what we call the North Star, Polaris, very close, within a fraction of a degree. And it wobbles very, very little. It's a very good gyroscope. You have to wait hundreds of years for the Earth's precession of its axis to move a little bit in some other direction. Astronomy is a fun subject. A buddy of mine, let me drop this, sent me a paragraph. Happens to be my brother-in-law. My brother-in-law sent me a paragraph of the book that he's writing. And he happened to get into a little bit of astronomy, and there was an error. And I started bringing it to his attention. While I was at it, I started getting him my philosophy of why I think of all the life that's out there, half of it is ahead of us, half of it's behind us. Because we seem to be in the middle of everything. It may be a very desirable place to be, but we've got a medium-sized planet, midway between downtown and suburbs of this particular solar system. We're going around a medium-sized star. That star is a third of the way from downtown to the suburbs of this particular galaxy. Our star is once every 250 million years. It goes around the center of this particular galaxy. It's a medium-sized galaxy. It's part of a local galactic group, or an average-sized galaxy in an average-sized galactic group, in an average position, a little bit off to one side of the center of this observable universe. And there's more and more data being gathered these days that could be interpreted as the fact that there is not one universe, there are multiple universes, multiverses. And one of those universes, the one that would suffer the Big Bang 13.7 billion years ago. And even that number keeps increasing. How long ago we assessed was the Big Bang. So we're in the middle of everything. We used to think that only one star has planets going around it, our particular sun. Let me drop. We're slowly discovering, by way of the Kepler satellite, among other things, we're suddenly discovering that the vast majority of stars have got multiple planets going around them. So what we used to think was a very rare event, a planet going around a star, is very plentiful. And if you take a look at the Stanley Miller Urey experiment, which was way back in the 1960s, I think it was, where they took a bunch of inert materials, put them in a flask, passed a spark through it, simulating lightning, did that for a week. And at the end of that week, you study the soup you've got in the bottom of that flask, and you realize that of the 20-some-odd amino acids, 13 of them have just been created by this so-called random process. The suggestion is that if you start off with the right material, life will form every time. It has no choice, so to speak. It's one of these universal laws of science saying that if enough material is interacting for a long enough period of time, every reaction that is not forbidden is compulsory. Another way of looking at that is you start off with enough material and let it react for a longer period of time under the right conditions, every possible reaction will take place. The forming of the amino acids and the eventually forming of life appears to be one of those. If Stanley Miller had waited long enough, in theory, life would crawl out of the top of that flask where he was doing that experiment. He spent the rest of his life doing various versions of that experiment because he was so enthralled by the fact that forming these very complex amino acid living things was so easy to do. Just passing a spark through a bunch of inert materials will do it for you. The plasma that's created by a lightning spark has got all kinds of high energy physics going on. It creates all kinds of reactions of those molecules. And why air will break down and why it makes a spark, you'd be amazed how much is going on at the molecular level when you start studying that. I know we're way off the side, so I'm just telling you some of the information I gave to my brother-in-law recently, which some of which I don't think he had heard before. What do you recommend next, John? Do you think we can hear people on on the western input. It's worth a try. KC2WGB for a suggestion. K2RIW. And doing a little bit of a delay. If anybody would like to join us, sign in right now. Give us your call letters. K2RIW on the TechNet listening.
I expected Wesley to come on. I know he had a question that he was looking to ask. But Dick, I wonder if they would run that same experiment you just spoke about on Mars. I wonder if they could set up a little laboratory, and I wonder if the results would be the same. Something to think about.
By the soil that's above it. I am convinced that you would still form life on Mars more slowly, and did life on Mars in the more slowly forming method of my hypothesis, did it get a chance to form before the planet became dry and nearly low in atmosphere? Because Mars has a very low magnetic field, the solar wind particles that are whipping by at roughly a million miles an hour have been continuously peeling away the atmosphere and peeling away the moisture on Mars. So Mars was a much more humid, virulent, what's the word I'm looking for now?
Robust.
This is a good word. But it would probably was a much friendlier environment at some later time. And did life have enough time to form before the atmosphere got peeled away is an interesting question. So depending on how you do the experiment, Mars, you might get a similar result. But it's a darn good question. KC2, WGV, K2LIW in the Tech Man.
I did hear Wesley in there. I know he was listening. So if you can, Wes, you can pick it up. Dick, also, maybe with the different compound formulation and the percentage variant, maybe we could create different amino acids or something else would happen. But I think that would be an interesting, maybe they're doing it, I don't know. But that could get some good results, I think.
Yeah, the original Viking experiment, partially set up by Carl Sagan, did a pretty good job of doing some laboratory measurements, trying to find where the raw ingredients of life present. And I think the experiment was essentially negative. I think they didn't find life. Well, you got to be careful now. Because you drop a spacecraft down on Mars, you scoop up a little bit of the soil, you do an experiment, and you say no life is here. Well, by the same token, I could walk over to the ocean, scoop up a glass of water, look at the glass of water and say, there were no sharks here. I could easily make that assessment. You got to be careful you don't generalize in particular. If your sampling process is too small, you could easily come up with a null set, a negative result, a false negative. So the fact that we've made a few measurements on a little bit of the soil in a couple of areas on Mars and not seen a clear indication of life doesn't mean that life never was there. But even if life, if we can't find any evidence of life on Mars, that's not a showstopper. Mars is not the friendliest environment. Venus is not the friendliest environment. At 800 or 900 degrees Fahrenheit, with a high acidic atmosphere and an extremely heavy atmospheric pressure, Venus is not a desirable place for life as we know it, hydrocarbon life. Biological hydrocarbon life. But when you've got 10 to the 22 stars, the average galaxy has somewhere between 100 million and 400 million stars per galaxy, and there's something like 100 million observable galaxies. And we're now discovering that almost all of those stars, by our standards, have planets going around them. Even some of the double stars have got planets going around them. When you've got that many planets on that many stars, which is very large statistics, unless the formation of life is a thoroughly forbidden outcome of the experiment, there's got to be other life out there. And of that life that's out there, because we seem to be in the middle of everything, I'm convinced that half of that life is way ahead of us and half of it's way behind us in technological progress. Some of those guys have had a million years of head start, is my speculation. Look what we have done in technological progress in the last 100 years. Can you imagine if we had a million years to do that technological process? Some of those guys have had a head start on us. And it's enough to make you start thinking about UFOs. And by the way, of all the zillions of books that were written on that subject, and the majority of them are pretty bad books, there is one rather good book in my opinion. It's entitled Witness to Roswell. The author is Carrie, C-A-R-E-Y, and Schmidt, S-C-H-M-I-T-T. You want to get Witness to Roswell, revised and expanded edition. $14 at Amazon. And what makes this book so significant is that these two investigative reporters have been hearing a story about Roswell over and over again for 60 years. And they said, what in the world is going on here? Let's go there and put this Don story to bed. Let's get rid of the story. That started 22 years ago. These two guys go to Roswell and start interviewing people. The net result was over the last 20 years, they interviewed 600 residents of the town of Roswell, New Mexico. 600 people, 20 years, two investigative reporters. That's a lot of talking to people. A lot of those were deathbed declarations where they no longer worried about is their pension going to be canceled, nor are their relatives going to be incarcerated. They were threatened along those lines. When you listen to those stories of those 600 people, you can't possibly believe that 600 people of the ones that were interviewed all decided to make up this great big hairy story because they're going to get rich quick. Nobody's getting rich quick. And Schmidt and Carrie selling this book for $14, they're not getting rich quick. So what are the motivations if this really is what these people, what these eyewitnesses saw? And so something rather significant took place there in 1947, and we haven't heard the end of it yet. It's the most significant apparent UFO hardware capture and gouging a great big hole in the ground, so to speak, by the hardware and bodies being recovered. All kinds of things that are hard to believe. And there's a strong amount of more than circumstantial evidence that something took place. One of my buddies is absolutely positive. Let me drop this. That anybody who has had a UFO experience is really responding to fairies and pixies and leprechauns, as he puts it. Well, I don't think so. But that guy with that very strong opinion, a man in the Dallas area of Texas, I mailed him a copy of this book. And I said, okay, Kent, tell me which chapter of the book has the most amount of error, in your opinion. You're a pretty smart guy. You've talked to a whole lot of people. That town is in your backyard, so to speak. Your town is where an awful lot of the hardware went temporarily before it went to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base to be thoroughly investigated by the Mattel Institute. Tell me which part of the book you think contains the greatest amount of error. I haven't heard from him. The silence is deafening. So to me, it's a fairly strong piece of evidence that the book is something you can't easily dismiss. Should we all jump onto that bandwagon and believe that? Maybe not. But at least to think that we're completely alone, that we're the only society in this universe, and there's more than one society, that we're the head of the pack, to come to any of those conclusions would require a hell of a lot of arrogance. And there isn't much evidence for that. Over to you, John. You think we're going to be able to hear Wes, KC2WGB? Are you hearing him on the input, or is he coming through the machine? Over to you, John, K2RIW.
He was coming through the machine, so I'm sure he'll be able to get through it. By the way, Dick, you mentioned that gentleman's name that did that experiment with the amino acids. I think you said Renkind. Is he the guy who also developed the American Kelvin scale, which has absolute zero? Is that the same guy?
US2N.
First of all, the guy we're talking about, WS2N, I heard you, Paul, I'll get you in a minute. We're talking about Stanley Miller. Stanley Miller, along with Harold Urey, at the University of Chicago, roughly 1956, did this experiment. Stanley Miller, who was a student of a very respected chemical expert, Harold Urey. So the Urey-Miller experiment was this experiment of taking inert materials that are what we believe was on the Earth in the early days, putting them in a flask, and passing a spark through it, and analyzing the results after a week of sparking. So that was Miller and Urey who did that. They're not the guys who set the temperature scale, as I see it, John. Paul, I think you wanted to say something. John, yeah, Paul. WS2N. I'm hearing you, Paul. Go right ahead. K2RIW.
70s Carl Sagan, and he says a colleague of his, Bizarre Car, named B-I-S-H-U-N Car, K-A-R-E. an electrical discharge.
That gives me some good information.
Yes, material. The color turns out to be the same color that you would find in the color of the clouds of Titan, which is the moon around Saturn. So, it's based on his theory, you know, they're saying, well, maybe if you got enough electrical discharges, you might be able to find some kind of life on Titan. And they were trying to duplicate it here in the with the test tube.
Testing. Now, part of what's up
call was saying is there is as much water on Europa as there is on the Earth. This is a very thick layer of water. And so the space probe that was supposed to go to Europa, the second moon, major moon around Jupiter, that program has been set aside for the time being because NASA, with limited budget, is putting a lot of their eggs in the basket for the James Webb Space Telescope. The James Webb Space Telescope is 7.5 times bigger in telescope area than Hubble, and it operates in the deep infrared, and it's going to be put into a more desirable location. So you take the Hubble Space Telescope, which arguably is the most productive piece of hardware that NASA has ever created. You take a look at that ultra-deep field photograph that they did with the million-second time exposure, the 2,600 galaxies in there that have never been seen before, and a lot of them are at greater distances than have ever been seen before. I mean, with such a high-output piece of hardware called Hubble Space Telescope is about to be duplicated, 7.5 times bigger in area, and infrared in frequency, and put into a more desirable location, Lagrange point number 2. You put that all together on that particular launch on 2018, it's a predicted launch date. That, in theory, could do 10 times more real serious space investigation, astronomical measurement, than Hubble. So for them to put much of their resources into James Webb, I think is a good decision. As it is right now, I forget what the number is, but I think each man, woman, and child is putting a nickel of their dollars worth of taxes into NASA right now. And are we getting our money's worth? By my standards, we certainly are. Maybe it's 2 cents, maybe it's a nickel. I'm not sure. Of every dollar goes to NASA. And from time to time, they keep cutting back the funding for NASA. And we're getting an awful lot out of that, the fallout. I mean, if you want to be negative, you can say, let me drop.
K2IW, K2KMD was trying to break in. K2IW.
K2IDT, okay. When it comes to listening to myself coming back, I've got to decide which one of the four frequencies to listen to. So maybe I didn't hear KMB. Rich, you want to say something? Think about it ahead. K2KMB, K2RAW.
Well, yeah, Dick, you know, we try to give you real time just in case there's guys on the road. So at this point, it's already about 2 or 3 minutes later, but this guy was heading back west, most likely on the southern state, and at the time that I was talking, he was probably in the Farmingdale Republic area airport, in that particular area. But he is heading west again, and, you know, do whatever you have to do. But this is probably the last time we'll deal with this evening. But, again, just trying to give you real-time reports. This is K2KNB.
Very fine, Rich. Keep up the good work. It's quite a detective story, if you know what I mean. It's going on for quite a long period of time. And for this guy to devote his life to being disruptive for such a long period of time, easy to get mad at him. That's not the right response. You got to feel sorry for him. The fact that he's devoted his life to being disruptive. How in the world can he